Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Earlier this summer, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor announced that she would be stepping down from the U.S. Supreme Court. It had been widely expected there would be a vacancy on the court, but I think most people expected the vacancy would be created by the resignation of the Chief Justice, Mr. Rehnquist. Now there is a very real possibility that sometime over the next couple of years, the Bush administration will have the opportunity to name two new justices to the High Court. And in fact, last month, the administration announced that federal judge John G. Roberts would be the choice to replace Ms. O'Connor. The Senate has scheduled hearings, confirmation hearings for Judge Roberts for about a month from now, first week of September, and it is possible, certainly possible, that if confirmed by the Senate, he could be in place by the time that the court opens for business on the first Monday in October. This morning, in this part of the program, we'll be talking a little bit about both the process and also the background of the nominee. And our guest for the show is Erwin Chemerinsky. He's professor of law and political science at Duke University. He's been at Duke since 2004. Before that, he was, for a number of years, professor at the University of Southern California Law School. He's been a trial attorney at the U.S. Department of Justice in Washington and also an attorney in private practice in Washington. He's taught at DePaul, Duke, Loyola of L.A., and UCLA Law Schools. He's the author of four books, most of them concentrating on constitutional law. He has written more than 100 law review articles that have appeared in journals, including the law reviews at Harvard, Michigan, Northwestern, University of Pennsylvania, and Stanford. He also writes a regular column on the Supreme Court for California Lawyer, the Los Angeles Daily Journal, and Trial Magazine. He is also a frequent contributor to newspapers and other magazines. As we talk this morning, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's for folks who are here right where we are. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call for you, if you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, or you might be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Chemerinsky, hello.
Good morning. Nice to talk with you.
Well, we certainly appreciate you giving us your time. Perhaps I could begin by asking you to give us your general assessment of Judge Roberts.
My assessment is we don't know very much yet. Despite all the information that's come out about his opinions, his speeches, his answer to questionnaire, we don't have a sense of, is he likely to be a mainstream conservative in the mold of Sandra Day O'Connor? Is he much more likely to urge radical change in the law like Clarence Thomas? That's the key question that the Senate Judiciary Committee is going to have to find out next month.
It seems to be the case that conservatives have responded positively to his selection. And yet on the liberal side, and it may indeed be for the reasons that you cite, people have been a little bit careful. I mean, there are various organizations, for example, people who are concerned about the right to choose an abortion have voiced concerns, and there is a lot of concern about the possibility that a future court might overturn Roe v. Wade. But it seems that overall, on the left side of the political spectrum, people are being a little bit careful, a little bit reserved in their comments. Is that indeed because the record is a little uncertain?
That's right. At this point, we don't know what John Roberts thinks as to whether or not the Constitution protects the right to privacy. We don't know what John Roberts thinks about separation of church and state. We don't know what he thinks with regard to affirmative action. For liberals, there are many troubling indications of his beliefs, but I think rightly we have to say we need to know more. Conservatives are embracing him, but they too really don't know much more than the rest of us of, well, what's John Roberts going to do on all of these issues in the Supreme Court?
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously what happens when someone is nominated, all of the folks in Washington and elsewhere, people who are interested in arguing either for or against that person, go out there and they see what kind of record there is. They want to look at the previous decisions this person has made if they're a judge. They want to look at everything, virtually everything they've ever said, everything they've ever written, everything that can be found out to offer some clues. And then that's all put out there, and the person comes and sits there before the Senate and answers questions. Is it how good an indicator is a person's past record of what that person would do if he or she then became a member of the Supreme Court.
With rare exceptions, people don't undergo major ideological transformations in their 50s and their 60s. We are, by then, who are likely to be ideologically. There are some exceptions of people who have shifted on the Supreme Court. Harry Blackmun became much more liberal. Felix Frankfurter became much more conservative. But the reality is people are who they are with regard to their beliefs and ideology. So if you have a nominee who said all along that Roe v. Wade was properly decided, or a nominee who said all along that Roe v. Wade was wrong and should be overruled, that's what they're likely to do on the Supreme Court.
Now, what's a little bit confusing, I think, for people is that it seems that Judge Roberts has said both of those things, or at least he said he's on the record of saying, having written, that he thought Roe was wrongly decided and should be overturned. And then on the other hand, he's also on the record of saying, well, it's settled law, so that might seem to indicate that that was that.
It's a bit more complicated than that.
Yeah.
As a lawyer in the Justice Department, in fact, one of the top lawyers in the Solicitor General's office, he wrote briefs that Roe versus Wade should be overruled. Now, those briefs may or may not reflect his views, but no one has to put their name on a brief, and he did advocate that to the Supreme Court. So it's a strong indication of his views, and that's, of course, why groups that support abortion rights, like the National Abortion Rights Action League, the National Organization of Women, the Feminist Majority Foundation, are opposing John Roberts. On the other hand, when he was up for confirmation for the D.C. Circuit, he said that Roe versus Wade is settled law. The problem with that is, as a Court of Appeals judge, he was obligated to follow Roe versus Wade. That doesn't tell us what he's going to do on the Supreme Court, where he could cast a vote to overrule Roe versus Wade. It goes back to what I was saying a moment ago. We really don't know where is John Roberts on this issue.
Yeah. When I suppose it depends on people's own political orientation, with how they look at justices and what their political outlook seemed to be when they were first named to the court, and how that might have changed over time. And for example, there have been some people who consider themselves conservatives who think that there's some worry that over time, even a person who starts out being conservative might become more liberal. And so conservatives worry and liberals hope that if Judge Roberts is named to the court, that over time he might become more liberal. And on the conservative side, they point to, they make this argument that, in fact, Justices Stevens, O'Connor, Kennedy, and Souter all over time have become more liberal. Now, maybe that's not exactly true, but I'm interested in your argument that by the time that people get to the Supreme Court, they are who they are, and we really shouldn't expect that they're going to change very much. How much do people do change?
Well, it depends on the person, and I think it's much more complicated. Let's start with William Rehnquist or Antonin Scalia or Clarence Thomas. They all came onto the court staunch conservatives. They remained staunch conservatives. No one knew what David Souter's views were before he came onto the court. No one could say that David Souter became more liberal because no one knew who he was. John Paul Stevens was a fairly liberal Republican when he was on the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. I don't think that overall he's become more liberal during his time on the court. O'Connor and Kennedy are a more difficult characterization because they came on the court conservative, and they'll leave the court conservative, but they're much more pragmatic than ideologues in the mode of a Rehnquist, Scalia, or a Thomas. They don't have strong ideological commitments to a particular view of the law. And so they usually vote conservative, but sometimes disappoint their conservative supporters. I think the question is John Roberts in the mold of O'Connor or Kennedy, or is he in the mold of Rehnquist, Scalia, and Thomas?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm interested in your comment that we just don't know. I would think that the Bush administration at least would think that they know. And given the fact that they've said that that they wanted someone in the mold of Justice Scalia, they're looking for somebody who will be like that, that the very fact that they selected Judge Roberts would indicate that at least they think that's what they're going to get.
Well, that's, of course, why John Roberts is concerned to progressives. The worry is, does the Bush administration know that they're getting another Scalia or Thomas, but if somebody without the paper trail to prove it? And if there is another Scalia or Thomas, then I believe that it's essential that the Democrats filibuster and reject that person. If John Roberts is going to be the vote to end constitutional protection for privacy, if John Roberts is going to be the vote to end all affirmative action, If John Roberts is going to be the vote to end campaign finance law in the United States, if John Roberts is going to be the vote that says there's no limit on the ability of the government to put religious symbols on government property, give aid to parochial schools, then he's so far out of the mainstream, he has to be rejected.
Mm-hmm. And just to make sure that people understand now, what will happen is that we'll have hearings. The judge will appear before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and no doubt they will call other witnesses to ask them one way or another what they think about Judge Roberts. The Judiciary Committee will make some kind of recommendation. The full Senate will vote. If Democrats decide they want to block this nomination, can they?
Under current Senate rules, they can, because the current Senate rules would allow the Democrats to filibuster. It takes 60 votes to end a filibuster. There are only 55 Republican senators. The reason I hesitated a bit is there was an effort by the Republicans in June to end the filibuster of judicial nominations. A compromise was reached where the filibuster rules were left in place, and Democrats agreed they would only filibuster in extraordinary circumstances. The question then will be, will the Democrats regard John Roberts' ideology as extraordinary circumstances? Here, too, it's just too soon to know until we know what is John Roberts' ideology.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, if I said to you, do you think that he will be confirmed, would your answer at this point be, I don't know?
It's too soon to know. Yeah. But I think it's quite notable that none of the Democratic senators have formally endorsed John Roberts. The Senate Democrats are all individually and as a group taking the position they need to know more. So while the conventional wisdom is Roberts is going to be confirmed, and if any of us were betting in Las Vegas, if there were such bets, of course, we'd bet in that way. But I think at this stage, we just don't know enough to know whether or not the Senate Democrats will get together and say, he's too far out of the mainstream.
Yeah. Perhaps just one more question, and I have a couple of callers here I want to include. I think that, as I said at the beginning, there had been for some time this expectation that in the near future, the Chief Justice, Mr. Rehnquist, would be stepping down because of his health problems, and that both conservatives and liberals had been gearing up and raising a lot of money for a very heated battle. And when Judge Roberts was named as the choice of the White House, I think a lot of people said maybe it wouldn't be quite as intense a battle as we had thought. Now, still, though, that we still have the possibility that sometime soon Mr. Rehnquist will step down. Do you think that, and then some people are saying that they think that that fight would be the big one, would be even more intense than this. I wonder what you think about that kind of scenario.
The fight depends entirely on the identity of the nominee. The O'Connor seat in the short term is much more important than the Rehnquist seat. Replacing William Rehnquist with another conservative isn't going to change results in cases. Replacing Senator O'Connor with somebody much more conservative will change results in the areas that I mentioned, like abortion, affirmative action, campaign finance, separation of church and state. Had President Bush picked a hard right conservative with a long paper trail, like a Janice Rogers Brown or an Edith Jones or a Michael Luttig, we would have seen already the fight you described. But for John Roberts, there's not enough information yet for a fight. Same thing when William Rehnquist retires. If President Bush picks a hard right conservative with a long paper trail, the fight will start immediately. If he picks somebody where less is known, then there won't be a fight until there's more information.
We have as our guest in this first hour of Focus 580, Erwin Chemerinsky. He is professor of law and political science at Duke University, and we're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court and what will be happening now that Justice Sandra Day O'Connor has announced that she's going to retire. The Bush administration has named someone to replace her, and that's Judge John Roberts. He's a federal judge. There will be hearings in the Senate the first week of September. They're scheduled to begin on September 6th. And also, we are planning to air live coverage of the hearings for people who are interested in following them. We're expecting National Public Radio will cover them live, and whatever they provide to us, we will put on the air. So you'll have the opportunity to listen here on the station. We have some folks here who want to get out on the conversation, and we'll start here with somebody on our line number one right here. Hello.
Hello, Professor Chemerinsky. I'm calling because, one, I'm concerned about the stealth candidate, and I hope I'm not being disrespectful to John Roberts, and since we don't know much about him, but the fact that the religious right and big business seem to have approved of his nomination sends bad signals to me in terms of what his real political or ideological stripe might be. And secondly, the fact that people now don't want to claim up to the fact they were ever members of the Federalist Society, including now John Roberts, who can't recall. My experience with the Federalist Society in law school was a very conservative group, primarily designed to combat the liberalizing of the judiciary. So my question to you, with these two matters at issue, are you very much concerned about John Roberts, irrespective of the paper trail or the lack of a paper trail?
I am, and you make two excellent points. As to the first, you can always judge somebody by who their friends are. And when you've got the religious right so enthusiastically endorsing John Roberts, it causes reason for concern, especially so because there are four justices on the current court who believe that the government should be able to give aid to parochial schools, even if it's used for religious instruction. There are four justices who believe that the government should be able to put any religious symbols on government property. Will John Roberts be the fifth? The second issue in terms of the Federalist Society, you correctly describe it. If you go onto the website of the Federalist Society, it says it exists to counter liberal ideology. Well, John Roberts was involved with the Federalist Society. Nothing wrong with that, any more than it's anything wrong to be in the ACLU or a liberal organization. But again, it's an indication of what his views are. Everything we know about John Roberts points in the direction that he is very conservative. And the question is he going to be a conservative like O'Connor or Kennedy, or is he going to be conservative like Scalia or Thomas? If the latter, then I think the Senate would have to reject him.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you for the call. We will continue, and we have someone next up in Champaign County, line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
This Federalist, have you ever been, our sort of thing, was pretty ham-handed, and it seems to me that I don't understand what, you know, I guess, well, not much is being made of it for some reason. I mean, the fact that they denied it and then had to print a retraction of the retraction and all that sort of stuff just seemed to be totally ham-handed. You brought up the parochial school aid thing. When Roberts was at Durbin's office, reputedly he said when in issues of Catholicism he would have to recuse himself. Now, I don't think he was talking about reproductive aid, but something like something like aid to parochial schools. What do you make of that? I haven't heard a lot of discussion of that one either. I have some things about Griswold and Sullivan in this environmental ruling that Roberts was in the dissent on. We don't have much to look at, as you say, but he's putting that on the Commerce Clause. But it seems to me that he's more it's more of a takings kind of thing in that whole body of argument. I'm sure you can develop that probably better than I, but if you'd comment some.
Sure. In terms of the Federalist Society, the reality is there's nothing wrong with being a member of it, and I find it curious that he wanted to deny it. All that tells us is he's a conservative, and we already knew that he was a conservative.
No, what I'm talking about is the White House. The White House denied it, made the New York Times print a retraction, and then they found evidence that, he was actually on a steering committee for a rather major project of the Federal Society, even though then he said, well, I don't remember paying any dues. But, I mean, that's just ludicrous. What I'm saying is that just the spin control seems to be a little ham-handed.
Absolutely. So he's a member of the Federal Society that tells us he's conservative. I'm not sure why they did all that you described that has happened. In terms of the conversation with Senator Durbin, it was reported in a piece by Jonathan Turley that was in many major national newspapers. Roberts denies now ever having told Senator Durbin that he would recuse himself if there was a conflict between his Catholic ideology and an issue that would come before the court. Senator Durbin has neither confirmed nor denied that Roberts said that. Now, obviously, nobody should ever be denied any position because of his or her religious beliefs. John Roberts is entitled to his faith just like all the rest of us are. On the other hand, if we know that John Roberts, for whatever reason, was going to be the vote to overturn Roe versus Wade, if we knew that John Roberts was going to be the vote to allow unlimited aid to parochial schools, he should be rejected from the court because of those views, whatever their source, but no one should ever be rejected because of their religion.
What about this environmental ruling that he was a dissenter on? It was about suing, and he used the Commerce Clause, saying there was no abridgment of interstate commerce involved. Therefore, I gather he implied that the Endangered Species Act and that provision, or the way that's being used, was unconstitutional, which didn't go anywhere. But I think there is a lot of sympathy. But I have the feeling that there's a subtext there, which it has to do with this whole private property and takings, because that was what the substance of the ruling would have allowed. It allowed some land use to be prohibited in somewhere out in the West.
The D.C. Circuit that Roberts sits on voted that the Endangered Species Act is constitutional. It's a proper exercise of Congress' authority to regulate commerce among the states. Every court to rule on the question has come to the same conclusion. The Supreme Court has denied review in all of those cases. Roberts dissented from the denial of review by his entire court. He said he would want to consider the issue of whether the Endangered Species Act is constitutional. The reason it's so important is, over the last decade, the Supreme Court has narrowed the scope of Congress's power to regulate commerce among the states. Every federal environmental law was adopted under the Commerce Clause authority. Many federal civil rights laws, most federal criminal laws were adopted under this. If he would vote, as Justice Thomas does, for instance, to limit the Commerce Clause in a radical way, that would put in danger the Endangered Species Act, all federal environmental laws.
And a body of other laws, you're implying?
Absolutely.
Mm. I wanted to get back to the choice issue, and I've just read a book portions thereof, People's History of the Supreme Court, which the guy that eventually released audio tapes over the objections of the court in the archives.
I'm forgetting. Peter Irons, a law school classmate of mine.
Yeah, it's an amazing book in that it covers the historical. But it seems to me that Douglas was actually more instrumental in Roe v. Wade than the writer of the thing. And if he'd had written it, it would have been entirely different. He was involved in Griswold versus Connecticut, which had to do with state making contraceptive sales to even married people illegal. And that's where this penumbra of privacy comes from. It seems to me that you can say the Ninth Amendment isn't very clear, but anybody who's being strict constructionist can't say that there isn't any privacy. You can say the word privacy isn't in the. I don't know. I'll let you just ruminate on that. I just can't believe that people can say there isn't any privacy allowed for in the Constitution, or it has to be done at the state level. When there's something that says that nothing in this Constitution should deny or disparage even other rights preserved to the populace. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Since early in the 20th century, the Supreme Court has said that privacy rights are protected under the Constitution, even though privacy is nowhere mentioned. And so in the 1940s, the Supreme Court said that an Oklahoma law that required surgical sterilization of anyone who committed three crimes involving moral turpitude was unconstitutional because it violated the right to procreate. The court said it was a fundamental right. And Justice Douglas, who you mentioned, wrote that opinion. And the court has protected a whole constellation of rights under the label of privacy. The right to marry, the right to have children, the right to custody of the children, the right to control the upbringing of the children, the right to keep the family together, the right to refuse medical care, and so on. Robert Bork was rejected for the Supreme Court in 1987, largely because he believed that there was no right to privacy under the Constitution, that all of these decisions were wrong. Scalia and Thomas take that position. I think one of the most important issues for John Roberts is, does he believe that none of these decisions were correct? They should all be overruled? That would make him unacceptable. Or is he like O'Connor and Kennedy, accepting that there has to be constitutional protection for privacy?
You know, one of the articles that I came across in looking at Judge Roberts and the coming battle suggested that some of the more bitter confirmation fights in recent memory have really been battles between senators who were liberal Catholics and nominees who were conservative Catholics. Is there some sort of religious subtext going on here?
I don't think so. I think it's much more between liberals and conservatives. and then the fact that you have Catholics on both sides of that divide becomes coincidental. Hmm. Edward Kennedy or Patrick Leahy would be regarded as liberal Catholics. Antonin Scalia regarded as a conservative Catholic. I think that their Catholicism isn't what's driving the disagreement. I think it's their ideology that's driving the disagreement. And this isn't a new phenomenon. I mean, it's not just about Robert Bork in 1987. In 1969, President Nixon had two picks for the Supreme Court, Haynesworth and Carswell, rejected because of their ideology. Over the course of the 20th century, over 10% of all presidential picks for the Supreme Court were rejected by the Senate. Over the course of the 19th century, 20% of presidential picks were rejected, almost all because the Senate disagreed with the ideology of the nominee.
Our guest, let me reintroduce our guest, and then we'll get on some other callers. Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580 is Erwin Chemerinsky. He's professor of law and political science at Duke University, has been at Duke since last summer. Before that, for a number of years, was professor at University of Southern California Law School. He's been a trial attorney at the U.S. Department of Justice in Washington and also attorney in private practice in Washington, and has taught at a number of law schools, including DePaul, Duke, Loyola of Los Angeles, and UCLA. Hey, we're talking this morning about the Supreme Court and the vacancy created by the announcement earlier this summer that Justice Sandra Day O'Connor would be resigning. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And our next caller up is in Champaign, line 3. Hello.
Hi, I'd like to talk to you about previous nominations and how they were different. When Ginsburg came before the court, became before the Senate to be nominated, what was the vote for her? Like, how did the vote shake out for her?
I think she was unanimously confirmed. I don't remember any no votes.
Now, this is a person, correct me if I'm wrong, who was the lead lawyer for the ACLU.
Well, actually, that's not correct. She was the head of the ACLU Women's Rights Project. She appeared 6 times in the Supreme Court in women's rights cases.
Okay, so it was pretty clear what her ideology was, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
She was a moderate
liberal.
She was
an avowed liberal.
Well, she's not a liberal either in her D.C. Circuit rulings on the Supreme Court in the mold of a William Douglas or a William Brennan or Thurgood Marshall. She's a moderate liberal on the ideological spectrum.
But she was still confirmed by 93, was that right? 93 of 96 senators who voted?
Well, I have no disagreement with that, but I don't think that tells us anything about whether John
Roberts
should be confirmed.
On her stand on abortion?
Well, if senators who are against abortion...
I'm asking you a question. Did they give her a litmus test?
Well, but I'm questioning why that matters, because...
Why is it one standard or a double standard is acceptable for one judge during a Senate, but it's not acceptable for another? Like, no one asked her any of those questions when they knew where she stood, and they didn't try to turn her into a caricature of herself by finding one thing that she wrote about. I mean, it seems to me unfair that you can, and the Republicans rolled over on this one. They rolled over almost unanimously on this woman.
I don't think there's anything unfair. The reality is Republicans blocked countless nominees of President Clinton for the Federal Court of Appeals and Federal District Court.
We're not talking about the Federal Court of Appeals. We're talking about the final word here.
But the reality is throughout American history, the Senate has rejected nominees because of their ideology. If your position is that it's wrong for the Senate...
They didn't even ask her what her ideology was.
Sir,
there was no litmus.
I won't interrupt you if you don't interrupt me.
It seems fair.
The reality is, if the Senate made a choice with regard to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, that doesn't mean the Senate can't make a different choice with regard to John Roberts. In 1987, the Senate rejected Robert Bork's ideology. In 1969, they rejected Haynesworth and Carswell. In 1991, 48 senators voted against Clarence Thomas. Now, if Republicans decided, for whatever reasons, they weren't going to oppose Ruth Bader Ginsburg, that doesn't make it unfair for the Democrats today to say that they will appoint John Roberts. The Republicans may have found Ruth Bader Ginsburg's views overall acceptable, but if the Democrats find John Roberts unacceptable, they have every right under the Constitution to reject
him. Seems like a double standard not to even ask, though. There was no litmus test. Like, there was no question as to whether she was going to vote for abortion or not, right?
Well, I think there's no question that Ruth Bader Ginsburg would vote to uphold abortion rights. But I think what you're doing is ignoring historical context. The
ones, like we're talking about the Supreme Court. We're not talking about anything below that. When they brought up nominations to the Supreme Court, the Republicans rolled over. And I don't see this Roberts guy as so controversial or so far that he has to have these litmus tests.
I think you raised two different points. The first is it appropriate for the Senate to consider a nominee's ideology? My point is that throughout American history, the Senate has done so. The fact that Republicans didn't do so in 1993 with Ruth Bader Ginsburg doesn't in any way tell us what's appropriate for the Democrats or any senators to do today. They have the right under the Constitution to decide whether a nominee is so far out of the mainstream as to not be confirmed. The second point you raise is John Roberts so far out of the mainstream that he should be rejected? And if you've listened this morning, I have not taken the position that he should be rejected. I said we don't know enough to come to a conclusion yet at this point.
I'm going to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me, because clearly the caller and the guest are not going to see eye to eye on this point, and I have some other calls to take. It seems to me that the caller is suggesting a general kind of point, which I guess I would expect that you would not agree with. He seems to be contending that somehow that liberals are more have been more vigorous in their objection to conservative nominees than have conservatives in their objection to liberal nominees. You think that's not true?
I don't think that's true. Antonin Scalia was unanimously confirmed by the Senate in 1986, even though there was every reason to believe that he was extremely conservative, as he's turned out to be. In 1968, Senator Strom Thurmond led a successful filibuster to keep two of President Johnson's picks for the Supreme Court from being confirmed. And, in fact, they weren't confirmed because of the Thurmond filibuster. So I think that you've got to look at a longer historical period. And the reality is, over the course of American history, sometimes it's Democrats, sometimes it's Republicans that say that a particular nominee is just too far out of the mainstream to be acceptable.
All right. Well, let's talk with some others. We'll go to Chicago for our next caller. This is line four. Hello.
Hello, good morning. I don't know if you discussed this before, but I just came into it. My concern is that they are not releasing the papers that Roberts wrote when he was working for Bush 1, and I'm concerned about that because during that time, you remember, there were a lot of people pardoned from the Iran-Contra scandal, including some of the drug runners. And before that, during the end of Reagan's period, there were legal decisions that were made or legal questions that Oliver North put to the Justice Department and pretty much deals made between the Justice Department and the CIA. And I would like to know if Roberts was involved with any of that, and no one seems to be bringing that up. And I don't know if that's the short history of the news media. I don't think it's the short history of the public, but I'm concerned about that.
The reason it hasn't been brought up is that Roberts' role in the Justice Department makes it unlikely that he was involved. During the Bush administration, we're talking now of the first George Bush presidency, John Roberts was a top deputy in the Solicitor General's office. The Solicitor General's office represents the United States before the Supreme Court. Highly unlikely that John Roberts would be involved in decisions concerning the pardon or the immunity for Oliver North. And at the end of the Reagan administration, John Roberts was back in private practice. So that's why I think this hasn't surfaced as an issue.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And let's continue here. The next caller is in Indiana, line number one. Hello.
Hello. My question is very similar to her question, but mine deals more with mechanics. When it came out that the Bush administration wouldn't allow certain papers to be released because of the client-attorney situation, I'm sure I thought, you know, that may have just been a smokescreen to stop something from coming through. I wonder if you can make a comment about the mechanics of that thing and whether or not everybody, you know, presumes everybody is being fair and all hands are on top of the table and they're not trying to sense hide something from the Democrats that might appear if those papers were released, regardless of who the client was. Thanks.
You raise a great question. I wish I had a definitive answer. There is a principle that says that internal memos should be kept confidential so that people in the future will feel free to give their opinions and won't be inhibited by what might come out later. On the other hand, there have been instances where these kinds of memos have been disclosed. When Robert Bork was considered in 1987, the Reagan administration disclosed all of the kind of memos that are now being requested for John Roberts and where the Bush administration is refusing to turn them over. Now, is the Bush administration refusing out of principle? Are they refusing because they don't want certain information to come out? Obviously, until we see the memos, we can't know. The problem that underlies this is there's a need to know John Roberts' views. I've heard Republicans say, including on the national talk shows, that John Roberts shouldn't answer questions about his views, about issues that are going to come before the court. They say that these papers should not come out. Well, how is the Senate then going to know his views? And I think the Senate has every right to say, if the papers aren't turned over, that's fine. They just won't confirm John Roberts.
How did this precedent become established that when someone is being considered for the court, that they're entitled to be or expected to be or believe that they should be very, very careful about talking about what they would do in particular cases, to the point that it seems sometimes difficult to get people really to discuss their judicial philosophy?
That, too, is complicated. It's not at all new for the Senate to reject a nominee because of ideology. When George Washington picked John Rutledge to be the second Chief Justice of the United States to replace John Jay, the Senate rejected him for Chief Justice, even though it earlier confirmed him to be an Associate Justice. They said his views on the United States' position of neutrality in the war between England and France made him unacceptable. It wasn't until the 20th century, though, that nominees began to appear before the Senate for questioning, and very quickly they began to take the position that they wouldn't talk about things that were going to come before the court. Now, the problem with it is, how do we know their views? Just 3 years ago, Justice Scalia wrote an opinion for the Supreme Court saying that it's completely acceptable for candidates for elected judicial office to stake their views on disputed legal or political issues. It in no way makes them less impartial. It in no way threatens the courts to have them state their views. Well, I don't see why it's any different for appointed judges at the federal level than elected judges at the state level.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. We have some other calls we'll get right to. I just want to take enough time to introduce again our guest. And we're talking this morning with Erwin Chemerinsky. He's professor of law and political science at Duke University. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Munster in Indiana. Line number two.
Hi.
Yes.
I was calling about a caller about three calls back who was talking about Justice Ginsburg. And my understanding is the reason that she breezed through the court was because Bill Clinton had gone to Orrin Hatch, who was, I guess, the head of the justices, and brought up to him a list of potential nominees, and he picked her. He said that they would approve her, you know, unanimously. And I'm wondering, how often does that happen, where a president goes to the opposite party and presents a list like that and asks for their opinion? And my understanding is it didn't happen in this case. And I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
All right. Did that happen?
Well, I've never heard it quite that way. There's no doubt that Bill Clinton consulted with Republican senators, including Orrin Hatch, who was then the ranking minority member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. I've never heard it said that Hatch said, she's the one and did the selection. I always heard that President Clinton consulted about a number of individuals. The best description of the process that I've read was actually in George Stephanopoulos' memoir of the time that he was in the Clinton administration, so I assume that it's an accurate description. President Bush here also consulted with a large number of Democratic senators. We don't know if he listened to them, if he paid any attention to them, but he did consult with them.
All right. Another caller here, someone listening in Vermilion County, next door, line number three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call. My comments about Judge Roberts revolve around his involvement with Ken Starr. I mean, there was that investigation that was not looked on very highly by most of the population of the United States. And I'd like to know more about his involvement with that. And I'd also like to know a lot of more detail about his involvement with the 2000 election Supreme Court ruling that stopped the counting in Florida.
Sure. Ken Starr was the Solicitor General of the United States during the first President Bush's presidency. And John Roberts was his top political deputy. That means it was an appointed position, not a civil service position. It was an enormously important role in the Solicitor General's office. John Roberts had no involvement that anyone's mentioned when Ken Starr was the special prosecutor for Watergate and the Monica Lewinsky matter. So that's what we know about Ken Starr at this point and the involvement with it.
Hmm. And about the election of 2000?
There's no doubt. John Roberts was down in Florida helping the Republicans. So were lots of prominent Republican lawyers. On the other hand, I was down in Florida. In fact, I argued the butterfly ballot case in Palm Beach County Court for Al Gore. Lots of Democratic lawyers were there. To this point, there's no information that John Roberts did anything inappropriate or urged anything inappropriate in Florida. He was there as a lawyer helping Bush make his arguments, and I don't think there's anything suspicious about that. I think you'd find lots of prominent lawyers on both sides of the political aisle were down there then.
Is the caller still there? Does that get at your question?
Yes, fine. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about, and I hope that we have enough time here to talk about this, is it has to do with the fact that the Supreme Court, and this is a way in which the Supreme Court is different from other courts, the Supreme Court may overrule the decisions of a previous Supreme Court. Now, I guess it's my understanding that this does not happen all that often, but it's possible. And again, here, this is one of the reasons that people who are concerned about Roe v. Wade are concerned that a new court might overturn Roe. And this is also one of those things that people are very interested in finding out what Judge Roberts thinks about this principle, that this tendency to have decisions of previous courts to let them stand. How formal is that, and how many exceptions are there to that? How often, I guess the question is, how often has a given Supreme Court overturned a decision of a previous Supreme Court?
That's such a hard question to answer, because it is sometimes. I can list for you many instances where the Rehnquist Court has overruled precedent, even very recent precedent. Sometimes we'd all agree it's desirable. In 1954, the Supreme Court in Brown versus Board of Education expressly overruled Plessy versus Ferguson. Sometimes we may disagree with the Supreme Court overruling it. And I think the problem with asking John Roberts or any nominee about precedent is the answer has to be, I think precedent should be followed except in instances where it needs to be overruled. And they could point to Brown as an instance where Plessy needed to be overruled. And the question we really want to know is, well, what weight will John Roberts give to precedent when it comes to Roe versus Wade? Or what weight will John Roberts give to precedent when it comes to separation of church and state? Or what weight will John Roberts give to precedent when it comes to allowing affirmative action? And the fear is he's not going to answer any of those questions.
Mm-hmm. There has certainly in recent years been an awful lot of conversation about what is the appropriate role of the court and of justices, and what is their relationship to the Constitution, and what do you think the Constitution is? And so we come to the phrase judicial activism, which often to me seems to be something you just slap on somebody if they ruled in a way that you don't like. It seems that there are different ways of looking at what activism is. Is there any sort of – does that really have any sort of consistent meaning, or does it – can it indeed mean whatever you want it to mean?
I say the same thing. In fact, as recently as yesterday in a speech in New York City, I said I think judicial activism is just the phrase we use for the decisions we don't like. Now, I could come up with a descriptive definition of judicial activism. I'd say, if the court is following precedent, it's restrained. If it's overruling precedent, it's active. If it's upholding laws, it's restrained. If it's overruling laws and declaring them unconstitutional, it's active. By this notion, Brown versus Board of Education was enormous judicial activism, but absolutely essential and desirable. Now, I think when people speak of judicial activism, they're not using it in the descriptive sense. They're really using it in the normative sense of the label for the decisions they don't like.
Mm-hmm. I was very interested. There was a piece that appeared, I believe it appeared on the op-ed page of the New York Times now some time back, looking at this very issue. And the person who wrote the piece, and I apologize, I don't recall the name, you may have indeed seen it, made this argument, said, well, one way that you might look at the issue of activism is look at the tendency of the court to overturn an act of Congress. And if you look at it that way, you see that among the members of the court now, the most activist judges are Rehnquist, Scalia, and Thomas.
Paul Gewirtz, a professor at Yale Law School, wrote that, and he actually did a statistical survey, and it puts Thomas at the top of that list. And in reality, I think Clarence Thomas is the most radical justice on the current court, or in any in recent memory. I mean, Thomas, for instance, believes that there should be no limits by the Establishment Clause on state and local governments, that they should be able to do anything they want with regard to religion. That would overrule decades of precedent. Thomas believes, for example, there's no right to privacy in the Constitution, overruling a century of precedent. Thomas believes that affirmative action is always unacceptable, overruling precedent. Thomas believes Congress's Commerce Clause authority should only include the ability to regulate economic transactions, overruling decades of precedent, making every environmental law unconstitutional. So there's no doubt Thomas would be, from a descriptive sense, the most activist member of the court, and he's the most conservative member.
Mm-hmm. We have now for some time had, or at least for, I think, the last 10, 11 years, have had a stable court in the sense that we've had the same members, that it hasn't changed. And what I think is sometimes referred to as a natural court. And so we've had this natural court now for the last 11 years. And now definitely things are going to change with Justice O'Connor leaving. And I think that a lot of people expect that sooner rather than later, the Chief Justice, Mr. Rehnquist, will also go. So that'll be at least two new members, and it will change. And who knows in how it will change, but definitely we know that it will change. If you look at the court now that we are saying goodbye to, can you give some sort of overall assessment of this court and its personality and its approach to law and its approach to the Constitution?
It's overall been a conservative court. The reality is 7 of the 9 members were appointed by Republican presidents. More often than not, when it splits 5-4, the 5 in the majority are Rehnquist, O'Connor, Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas. That, of course, was the majority in Bush versus Gore in a 5-4 decision. But there have been a number of instances where the Rehnquist court has moved to the middle, not to the right, in the area of abortion, in the area of affirmative action, in the area of gay rights. And the question is, will John Roberts change all of these decisions and push the court further to the right?
And that's, again, to go back to some of your earlier comments, you seem to be saying, we don't know.
We don't know. And I think that the key question that every senator needs to try to figure out is John Roberts going to be a moderate conservative, well within the mainstream, like O'Connor and Kennedy, or is John Roberts really going to be from the far right, as Robert Bork would have been? That's what the Senate Judiciary Committee needs to assess.
Yeah. I think that we have this idea about the Supreme Court that in some sense it is in a bubble, and that the decisions are made based solely on the arguments, on the law, on the Constitution as the justices interpret it, and that in other sorts of ways it's supposed to be sealed off from political influence. And clearly, of course, that's not true. Is it the case in what sort of sense, I wonder, can you say that the justices do indeed pay attention to public opinion and may indeed be influenced by public opinion?
The justices never have to face election or a confirmation process. The Constitution, I think, was brilliantly designed to say we want judges to decide cases by their own best judgment of the law and the facts. Judges don't get lobbied. No matter what we say about our judiciary, you never hear of a lobbyist going and making appeals to Supreme Court justices or to judges in their chambers. That's just unacceptable, if not illegal. We have an incredibly clean federal judiciary. There's rarely any allegations of any corruption of a federal judge, and certainly never of a Supreme Court justice. And I think we tend to forget all of that. On the other hand, the justices are human beings. They live in society. That, while I don't think they ever base their decisions on public opinion, surely that has subtle or not so subtle influence on how they read the broad provisions of the Constitution.
And do you have there been particular cases, you think, where you can actually point to a court being influenced by perception of public opinion, or is it simply not that direct?
It's not that direct. It's much more complicated. You know, what causes a judge to come to a particular conclusion is a product of so many things. The judge's background and experiences, the judge's ideology, the arguments that are made by the lawyers, the context and facts of the particular case, and also public opinion. They're human beings. They live in society, but we've given them a very special and important role in the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. I think, as I said before, maybe more than once, that a lot of people had expected before Justice O'Connor announced that she would be stepping down, a lot of people expected if anybody was going to be resigning, it would be the Chief Justice, Mr. Rehnquist, because of his health. And I think that people are still expecting that, as I say, sooner rather than later, he will also resign, although it seems that he's determined to continue to serve and do his job as long as he's able to do it. What are people in Washington thinking these days about Mr. Rehnquist and how much longer he would be on the bench?
Well, William Rehnquist's thyroid cancer was the big story at the Supreme Court last year. I argued two cases in the court. One, he wasn't present, and then for the latter on March 22nd, he was sitting in his usual seat as Chief Justice. Everyone was speculating about when he was going to retire. Just a couple of weeks ago, he said, "Not going yet." No one knows. Will he be able to serve out the next term, maybe even a term after that? Will it be months rather than years? No one knows. And, of course, it's going to also depend on his health. And I respect his right to keep that information private.
Yeah. Well, there we will leave it. We want to thank you very much, Professor Chemerinsky, for talking with us today.
It's been a pleasure.
Our guest, Erwin Chemerinsky, he's professor of law and political science at Duke University.